Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to Chuck Gormley from CSNWashington.com for having joined us to discuss the Washington Capitals. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download both on iTunes and on the TSN1290.ca website. While you're at it, you can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Legal Curve. And the website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is www.illegalcurve.com. Gentlemen, we're going to spend the next couple segments looking at the schedules of the teams the Winnipeg Jets are chasing and or competing with for the final playoff spots. Before we start that, let me just go around the room and you guys can give me a yes or a no. You know, is there everybody behind the Winnipeg Jets now? So the New Jersey Devils being 4 points behind the Winnipeg Jets with 7 games remaining, and then Buffalo, Philly, Tampa, Carolina, and Florida. I think we're all in consensus that from Buffalo to Florida, they're all done?
Yeah, Buffalo to Florida, they're all done, Drew, as far as, and we've seen Buffalo and Florida come to town this week, and you need the eye test for that when they're done.
What about the Devils? The Devils are now 4 points behind the Jets.
They're 5 points behind the Jets.
Because they don't have a tiebreaker. So they're 4 points behind the Jets in terms of points. They don't have any tiebreakers because they only have 13 regulation wins. They have 7 games remaining. After that loss at home last night to the Ottawa Senators, Edzie, are your New Jersey Devils done?
I would have to think that they are done. The way that they've played over the last little while, I would have to say that they're done, even though, you know, there was a small ounce of hope left in me that they would make the playoffs. But at this point, even with Ilya Kovalchuk due to come back, it looks like he's not going to come back Monday versus the Leafs. The Devils are one loss away from probably being officially done.
Okay, so we're in agreement there. Richie, I assume you agree with that?
Yeah, they're done.
Okay, so you got nine teams battling out for 8 playoff spots. The Winnipeg Jets, is their best angle for the playoffs the Southeast Division still, or is it more realistic now that they're going to finish in one of the 7th or 8th spots?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know, Drew. I think one thing we want to point out before we delve deep into the Islanders, Rangers, the Senators, and Capitals schedules is that the Jets do have the tiebreaker. The regulation wins is a tiebreaker. The Jets currently have 20 regulation wins. The Capitals have 19, so that'll be the game in hand. So they have the tiebreaker right now on Washington. The Islanders have 18 regulation wins. The Rangers, 16, and Senators, 17. So that is going to be helpful for the Jets down the stretch here.
Simply because, I mean, the Jets will continue. I mean, it'll be a moot point if the Jets don't win the games anyways.
It's like an extra point, though.
Right.
Yeah, it's essentially like 1 point.
Because there's no way that the Rangers are going to catch the Jets in regulation wins and still have the Jets be competitive for the 8th playoff spot.
Exactly.
You know, the Jets need to continue to win, and they'll have a sizable lead in regulation wins almost over the entire conference. I mean, you know, if you look at the regulation wins, they're actually in 5th in the conference in that, you know, Pittsburgh and Montreal and Boston and Toronto. So we spoke about it briefly at the start of the show. Let's start with Ottawa. They have 48 points. They're 4 points up on the Winnipeg Jets, and they have a game in hand. Their schedule is as follows. They're at Boston, home to Carolina, home to Washington, home to Toronto, home to Pittsburgh, at Washington, and home to Philadelphia. So 5 of their last 7 are at home, a place where they've been tremendous all year long. Are the Ottawa Senators, in your mind, going to make the playoffs?
Yes, I do think they will make the playoffs. I think those losses were scaring a few people, but I think that, you know, with the schedule coming up, it's home heavy, as you mentioned. You've got those 4 home games in a row, and yeah, they're against hard teams, but I think the Ottawa Senators have proven that they're a pretty good team themselves, and you'd have to think that if they don't beat the Carolina Hurricanes, then they shouldn't be in the playoffs, but you know, I'd have to think that the Penguins game is going to be a tough one, as will the Leafs one, but you know, the Senators are, you know, they still want to be strong going into the playoffs. So I think Ottawa is probably the one team for me that is very unrealistic for the Jets to catch in that 6th spot.
You know, a 500 record over the last 7 games for Ottawa, is that going to be enough for them to get in?
Getting 7 points?
Yeah.
I mean, 7 points puts them at 55. That'll be pretty close. I mean, they have more regulation wins right now than New York does. I mean, you're talking about the Jets, really, right? And if they get 7 points, Senators will be at 55 points. The Jets have the Jets six games remaining.
Yeah.
So they'd have 56 points.
If they swept all six.
Yeah, so yeah, I do think, Drew, that a 500 record would be enough.
Let's look at the Capitals. The Capitals' record, the games they have left, they're home to Tampa tonight. They're home to Toronto, at Ottawa, at Montreal, home to Winnipeg, home to Ottawa, and home to Boston. You know, a lot of Jets fans are sort of pointing to that Jets-Capitals game as being the one that will determine if the Jets make the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible? I mean, is it likely that even if Washington loses that game at home to the Jets, they're still going to make the playoffs?
It's possible, but I mean, you look at that home-heavy schedule, right?
Yeah, and it's not an overly...
The Jets don't have a home-heavy schedule, too, but you know, you play at the, you home to the Lightning today, big game, should beat Tampa, home to the Leafs, really should beat the Leafs, and then you're at Ottawa, at Montreal, two hard games.
But the place they just won last week.
You don't have any back-to-backs, by the way.
Yeah, you know, no back-to-backs. And, I mean, you end the season at home against Boston, but who knows how much that game is going to matter at that point.
For the Capitals, for the Senators, too, the second last game, you don't know if the Senators play really well here. That game might get them locked into a spot.
That game against Washington you're talking mm-hmm. about. So you look at, I mean, those two teams, and, I mean, so it seems like, you know, we're in agreement that the best way for the Jets to go about this might be through the 7th, 8th, 9th position. Or part of the 7th and 8th position against the Islanders and the Rangers.
And what's also interesting here, guys, is you can break down all the schedules, and obviously the games in hand are really going to hurt the Jets, but when you look at the home games that the Capitals have, the away game against the Montreal Canadiens are fighting tooth and nail uh-huh. with the Boston Bruins for the Northeast Division lead, and you've also got the Ottawa Senators, who not only are they fighting for the playoffs, the Ottawa Senators are fighting to hold on to 6th. They'd rather play the Washington Capitals, I would think, than the Montreal Canadiens or the Pittsburgh Penguins. God forbid the Senators fall down to 8th. So the teams that they're playing, Montreal and Ottawa, Jets don't play Ottawa, but they play Montreal the last game of the year. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, you could say, you know, the Jets would play better against Montreal or not, those are still teams that can be dangerous because they're also fighting for seeding.
Absolutely. So you look at the Islanders game. So, I mean, we talked about this sort of briefly off the top of the show. The Rangers play the Islanders tonight. The one thing you don't want as a Jets fan is a three-point game. That's the number one thing you don't want. But in your opinion, would you rather have an Islanders win or a Rangers win?
I would say that you'd probably want, and, you know, Rangers haters aren't going to like this, but, you know, the Rangers have...
The Rangers have the extra game in hand. Have two games in hand on the Jets.
Right, the extra game in hand on the Islanders, I meant. So you'd probably, you know, want the Islanders to win so that you're keeping pace with the team that's directly in front of you. And right now, you're tied with the Rangers. But you mentioned it, Drew. That's really the key. I mean, however you slice and dice it, the Jets have to win either 4 or 5 of their last 6 games, okay? So they have to, that's a given. So we don't have this conversation. Everything is predicated on that. So if that doesn't happen, who cares? So you want one of these teams to not get a point. So obviously the Rangers, the Islanders. So the Jets probably, I would say, you want to keep pace with the team that's directly in front of you. But then again, the Rangers are a better team, so maybe you want the Islanders to start slipping.
If you look at it, just thinking in my head right now, if the Rangers win tonight... The Islanders, the Jets control their own fate.
They sort of do.
Because if the Rangers lose tonight, if the Rangers win tonight, the Islanders will have played the same amount of games as the Jets and will be two points up on the Jets. But the Jets play the Islanders. So if the
and
Rangers,
the Jets have the tiebreaker.
Yeah. Yes. So if the Rangers win tonight, the Jets can run the table and make the playoffs. Guaranteed.
Yeah. That is a guarantee. Exactly right. Making next Saturday's afternoon game against the Islanders. Who would have predicted at the start of the year that Saturday afternoon game at the end of the year against the Islanders, a game that most people would think, oh God, that's a dreg of a game, is really a game that almost could determine playoff positioning and playoff qualifying.
The first time the Islanders were here was definitely not a dreg of a game. Remember, it went to overtime and turned out to be favorable in as far as Winnipeg Jets fans go. But I think Richie's point is well taken. Really, it's going to be coming down to, you know, who wins more of their games, the Jets or the Islanders, if the Rangers are able to win tonight.
You control it. You want the Rangers to win because then you're the Jets fan and you control it. You play essentially playing heads up against the Islanders and say, let's go.
And the Rangers would still have a game in hand on the Jets mm-hmm. with a win tonight against the Islanders. The Rangers schedule, if you look at it, home to the Islanders, at the Islanders tonight, probably the biggest game on Long Island in 5 years.
Close to it, yeah.
Yeah. You know, at the Islanders, at Philly, home to Florida, at Buffalo, home to Jersey, you know, at Florida, at Carolina, home to Jersey again. The Rangers, I mean, the Jets' schedule isn't overly difficult, but the Rangers seem to have the easiest schedule, you know, among the teams battling for the final playoff spot in the Eastern Conference.
Absolutely. If you know, we're going under the assumption the Devils are out of it right now, you've got the Devils twice in your last four games, plus you've got road games against teams that are out of it, those being the Florida Panthers and Carolina Hurricanes. So you'd have to probably give the Rangers the easiest schedule out of the four teams, well, I guess five teams that we're talking about here. I guess Washington for now doesn't count, but aside from the Jets. But, you know, the Jets really, when you factor in that they're the ones chasing, probably don't have the easiest schedule.
You know, worth also noting the Islanders' schedule for the rest of the season. They obviously get their game in hand on the Jets tonight, home to the Rangers. They're home to Florida. They're at Toronto. They're at Winnipeg. They're at Carolina. They're at Philly. And they're at Buffalo to end the year. Five straight road games for the Islanders to end the year. Not against especially difficult competition, especially, you know, going up against Carolina, Philly, and Buffalo, three teams that all have nothing to play for at the end, but still five straight road games to end the season.
Great point, Drew, but think about Philly, Florida, and Buffalo. Tyler Myers appears out for the year.
Broke his leg, he's out for the year.
So Myers out for the year. Philly's got nobody to play one-on-one with Tavares, and now they're just Florida. So Tavares could go wild in those three games with nobody to defend him.
Yeah, not that Carolina's got a defense to write home. And the Jets, who probably have the best defense of all of those teams, we were saying earlier, it's still difficult for the Jets to stop them in that instance.
He tears it up. He could be MVP of the league. We'll talk about that last hour.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show for this Saturday afternoon. TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. A lot of chatter about the NHL and its participation in Sochi, Russia. And they're trying to get closer and closer to coming to a resolution that will see the NHL players make the trip overseas for the Olympics next year. The big sticking point, as we understand it at this point, is who is going to pay for the insurance on the NHL contracts. Obviously, the NHL teams, you know, need to take, you know, insurance needs to be taken out so that none of these players, if they get injured while playing overseas during the Olympics, that the NHL teams would be responsible. It's a big price tag, though.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're hearing, is that the price tag to insure these contracts comes in between 0.3 to 0.5% of the value of a player's contract. Now, these are all wealthy players because they're the best from each country. So just to explain what that actually quantifies at, it's best to look at Team Canada. So the CBC, Elliot Friedman in his 30 Thoughts piece, you know, took the a proposed Team Canada. So what somebody, you know, there's been the predictions of what the Team Canada is going to look like, and people are making those predictions. So he took the goaltenders at Carey Price, Cam Ward, and Roberto Luongo. When you total up the value of their contracts, it comes to $83 million. So then you take defensemen, Shea Weber, Drew Doughty, Duncan Keith, Brent Seabrook, Mark Stahl, Chris Letang. That's $194 million. And that doesn't even include Alex Pietrangelo, who's certainly in the mix, but he's not under contract for next season yet. Then you look at the forward groups. Crosby, Giroux, Taves, Stamkos, Perry, Bergeron, Nash, Stahl, Jordan Eberle, John Tavares, Mike Richards, Jamie Benn, Ryan Getzlaff. It's another $425 million. Any way you cut it, you look at Team Canada, and it's about $700 million worth of contracts that have been signed. 3% of 0.3% mm-hmm. of $700 million comes out to $2.1 million just to insure the contracts for Team Canada. Doesn't include travel, doesn't include anything else. $2.1 million just to insure the contracts. Who should be responsible for paying that? The NHL or the International Olympic Committee?
The International Olympic Committee should be responsible. Why? Because they're making all the profits. You have to quantify for the NHL here and say, well, we're putting out all this money. What are we reaping in terms of financially from this? Well, I actually don't know if that's quantifiable or not. If they're not directly receiving any money from it, the publicity of the game, how much is that worth? I don't know. But if the IOC is making money hand over fist, why are they not putting out any money and covering some of that risk? I don't get it. I mean, an IOC, by the way, is a very greedy organization. And I don't think they should get a free pass here. They have in the past, but the NHL is flexing a little bit of muscle because they know as that, you know, in prime time in the U.S., in Salt Lake City and in Vancouver, that's as good as you can get. Now you're talking 3-4 in the morning. We don't have to go. Maybe some of the Russian players would go and embarrass the league, and that's a factor as well. But overall, we don't have to go. We're not going to make a killing ratings-wise in North America. So hold on a second here. Somebody else has to cover this bill.
This whole issue seems to have been dragging on for so long here. I mean, you know, Drew, you mentioned all of the players that are going to play for Team Canada, and, you know, some of those might change, but, you know, the point being that those guys make a lot of money, and, you know, there've been, you know, discussions that, you know, these guys have signed longer-term contracts, and it comes down to the NHL bring, as Richie just pointed out, rightly so, that the NHL in Russia, in Sochi, Russia, in 2014 is going to bring a lot of money for the International Olympic Committee. And you have, you know, Gary Bettman, who was on HNL, talking about, you know, these issues are complex and all that. And, you know, I kind of laugh a little bit about that. Sure, they're complex, but really, you know, dig deeper in what that means is one guy wants to pay for it and the other guy doesn't. And,
right.
And they're at a stalemate. So, I mean, you know, are they complex or are you in a position where each guy knows exactly, you know, Gary Bettman knows the NHL is an extremely powerful organization. And, you know, the IOC in its own right is a powerful organization, but it's a much more, let's be honest, corrupt organization. And, you know, there's a really good book about it called Lords of the Rings, how, this is a much longer discussion, how cities get the Olympics in the first place. We're talking brown envelopes here. So, I mean, you're not dealing with, you know, it's not like you thought the NHL and the NHLPA was a battle of, you know, the heavyweights. Well, you're dealing with the IOC, and that's a whole different ballgame. You know, a guy like Gary Bettman isn't going to back down to the IOC. But Richie raises a good point. The NHL, sure, they get exposure, you know, and they gain fans. But the IOC is the big, you know, the big dog here, getting all of the, mm-hmm. the concessions, mm-hmm. the ticket prices, the TV revenue. That's all going into their pockets. If everything is going into your pockets, you should probably dig into your pockets and pay for the lion's share of the insurance costs. Mm-hmm. To me, that's what it's all coming down to. I don't see what the other issues are here. The NHL's participated in the Olympics since 1998. The NHL wants to go. The IOC wants them there. You know, this should be resolved. And, you know, again, I can't believe we're still talking about this. We should be talking about the teams already at this point, even though it's a year from now or just less than a year from now. We're still talking about who's going to pay for insurance. It's kind of ridiculous.
Worth pointing out, we had a comment on Twitter. They asked us who paid in for the 2010 Vancouver Olympics. The IOC, pardon me, the IIHF, the International mm-hmm. Ice Hockey Federation, covered the insurance in 2010, but it was it was at a much reduced price because a lot of these guys were sort of just hadn't signed their new really expensive contracts yet. So in 2010, the IIHF covered the cost of the insurance.
You're also, as he mentions, you know, why is it not done yet? Well, you're dealing with the NHL, who works on deadline hunting. You know, I think that's been on display in terms of the lockout. And Fear and Batman are working and negotiating this one. And what are they working towards? They're working towards a deadline. And, you know, we get strung along again. You know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me.
Who needs more? Who needs who more in this instance? With the Olympics in Sochi, Russia, which doesn't really work very well for North American television... Who needs who more? Does the NHL really need to go? Or is it just that they, you know, or does the IOC need the NHL to be there more?
That's a really good question.
Depends what you look at it from, Richie. It's not economics. The NHL doesn't need it from an economic position. I'm going to, you know, some people listening, and maybe you guys will even disagree with me, this growing the game thing is a little bit of BS to me. I mean, you know, growing the game to an international audience, I mean, the NHL is an extremely popular sport, and I think if you're a fan of the NHL, you're a fan of the NHL already. As far as how many new fans the NHL are going to get from the Olympics being in Russia, I would say it's not going to be mind-boggling. Sure, it's going to, you know, to me, it's about the NHL players wanting to go there and representing their countries. That's what it's about to me. Alexander Ovechkin wants to play for Team Russia at the Olympics. The NHLPA is listening to their players, and the players want to go. As far as, you know, this really is all about growing the sport, that's, to me, isn't, you know, the driving factor here. And as far as the Olympics go, you know, why wouldn't they want the NHL players there? They're going to make hockey, you know, much more appealing sport, and the television audiences will be higher. So I think both sides want to be there. As far as which side wants to be there more, I would probably say the NHL.
I think it's more about growing the game in Europe. As you're going to be at prime time or close to it, there are afternoon games, and you can try to increase your exposure. But
what does that mean, growing the game in Europe? Does that mean more people watching the game, or, you know, of this this ridiculous notion that one day the NHL is going to expand to Europe, which is never going to happen, in my opinion?
I think it's more so, you know, Finland makes a run, hockey's big there, or even, you know, a team like Slovakia, or I don't know if they're even in the, I'm not sure what if they're in the main pool or not. I haven't looked at that. The idea that an underdog nation can come and make a run, gather people to watch the games, kids will watch the games, and thereby, you know, turn to hockey as a sport that they want to play, and you'll see a huge trickle-down effect. Having said that, look at the Czech Republic. 1998,
Izzy. Yep.
They go and they make their historic run. Dominik Hasek, you know, saves on the save on Brendan Shanahan in the shootout, and they go and they win. That was how many years ago now? 15 years ago. Should you not see a real nice trickle-down effect in terms of hockey development in the Czech Republic? Well, apparently you really haven't seen that at all, by all accounts, unless I'm wrong. I mean, the Czech Republic has had a real swoon in terms of their production of younger players. And as he raises a good question, how much, and that's the thing, getting back to the point of the beginning of this conversation, how much of this is quantifiable? And if there's no, if you can't quantify it in NHL from the NHL's perspective, then why are you going to fork out so much money?
Let me ask this question. The 2018 Winter Olympics are in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Part of the reason Yeah, no kidding. Part of the reason I think they went this year is because it's in Russia and the NHL is populated by a significant number of Russian hockey players. And if they didn't go, those players might just go to the KHL and play there.
Yep.
In Pyeongchang, there's no South Korean Hockey League that's a viable option, as far as I know. I don't think there's any way the NHL goes to Pyeongchang, South Korea in 2018.
I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's something that is worth mentioning. I mean, it all started in Nagano.
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't exactly a hockey hotbed either. It all started in Nagano, and everyone remembers what happened, you know. When did you have to get up? 2 a.m, 3 a.m? They had that wake-up call service.
Yeah.
I mean, it was ridiculous. But I think that's a point worth mentioning. I mean, you know, South Korea, for all intents and purposes, is Siberia. You know, there isn't a lot of players that come from there. You have the odd. They obviously do have some level of professional hockey, but it's not going to be as appealing. I don't know if they won't go there, but I think if there are these issues, we're less than a year away here, and they haven't figured this out. I mean, again, it's easy for me to say, you know, I want these guys to figure this out. But when you're dealing with millions of dollars and each side thinking that the other side should pay, you know, foot more of the bill, it gets a little bit complicated.
It's also the World Cup. There's talk that the NHL is going to have a World Cup every 4 years and Olympics every 4 years and kind of be like soccer with the Euro 2000 and whatever it is, that year it's coming up, and the World Cup, where they play a significant international tournament every 2 years. And I would like that. I actually wrote about this a while back. I would love to see the World Cup come back, because I still think that the biggest problem with the Olympics is these one-game finals. I'd love to see a best-of-three
series
or a best-of-five with Canada against the U.S. I mean, imagine that hockey. They can strategize against each other. They can create a greater rivalry. I think it would be just amazing hockey. And the reports are the World Cup would now be in the middle of the season, not in September like the Canada Cups were and the 96 World Cup
was. That makes more sense for injuries and all that. When you have, you know, a situation where you have the World Cup in the fall, the timing really doesn't work, and that's where the World Cup has usually been.
Worth noting, in Sochi, Russia is 9 hours ahead of Winnipeg, and Pyeongchang, South Korea is 14 hours ahead of Winnipeg. I think this is the last Olympics that you're going to see NHL in for a while.
We'll have to wait to see what Kim Jong-un says.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN, TSN1290.ca. Down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back. to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. This segment of the program is brought to you by the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. The CGA Association of Manitoba is the largest, fastest growing, and most diverse accounting body in the province. Did you know that CGAs are among the top 5% of income earners in Canada, with an average yearly salary of $72,000 for new graduates? For more information, contact the CGA Association of Manitoba at cga-manitoba.org or give them a call at 204-477-1256. The CGA Association of Manitoba. We see more than numbers. Gentlemen, earlier this week, the NHL and NHLPA announced a partnership with the You Can Play Project. That project is spearheaded by Patrick Burke, son of Brian Burke, and it's an organization aimed at eliminating homophobia in athletics. The impetus for it was when Patrick Burke's younger brother, Brendan Burke, who happened to be gay, and he passed away in a car accident in 2010. So they founded this project sort of in his memory to try and make hockey a more welcoming environment, make sports a more welcoming environment for those who are homosexual and playing in it without any fear of homophobia involved. I think I speak for everyone when I say we salute the NHL and NHLPA for joining up with this organization. My question for you guys is, if or when a homosexual player comes out, an active homosexual player comes out, do you think it is going to make as big of a splash as people might think it's going to make?
I want to, first off, before I answer that question, I got to say something about Patrick Burke, because son of Brian Burke, we had him on the show, I believe, about a year ago.
Yeah,
he's a scout for the Philadelphia Flyers. You know, if you follow Patrick Burke, and I believe Legal Curve does, I definitely do, you know, he's very vocal on Twitter. This guy deserves beyond a lot of credit for what he's doing, because he is out there and he's getting NHL players involved. He deserves, I don't know how much, you know, credit or respect you can possibly give one guy, but what he's doing, it's a very selfless thing, mm-hmm. what he's doing. He's not doing this for himself. He's doing this for a lot of people. Whether it's homosexual players, people that have siblings or family members that are homosexual. I mean, you know, he deserves a lot of credit. First and foremost, he's doing a great job, and he's promoting it on Twitter and getting NHL players involved. You know, we asked him about that when he was on the show last year. You know, when do you think a player is going to come out of the closet, you know, in the NHL? And I think it is going to have an impact, because I think this is, you know, getting the discussion going, bringing up the awareness, and, you know, really what this is about. You know, first and foremost for me is respect and getting that bigotry out of the game. And, you know, there's a lot of joking around and foul language that goes around in a dressing room. And what this is attempting to accomplish is to essentially get rid of that and bring up the level of respect in hockey. And I think it's extremely impressive that the NHL is the first of the major four leagues to make a formal partnership announcement with the You Can Play project. But I think when a player does officially come out of the closet, Richie, it is going to be a big deal, because especially with the trailblazing that's been done by the You Can Play project, Patrick Burke and others, you know, it's going to be a big deal in the sense that, okay, finally a guy admitted, you know, that he's homosexual, and there's no big deal about it. And I think what, you know, people are going to say at the time when this happens is, good for him. He had a lot of courage to be the first guy.
I agree. I think it, you know, we talk about Patrick Burke and the credit he deserves. Also Brian Burke. I mean, Brian Burke is a polarizing figure, and people certainly love him or hate him, and there's a lot of both. But he has made great strides in terms of growing awareness in the game, obviously helping his son out, Patrick, but also, and obviously in his son Brendan's memory, you know, attending gay pride parades and, you know, getting criticized for it on Free Agent Day, I believe it was, and other things. He's got a big picture in mind, and he's done great work in that regard. And I echo Ezzy's sentiments in terms of, it's not going to be, you know, we were talking about it before the show, will it be a big deal? Because it isn't a big deal. I mean, I don't want to denigrate how important it is. It is important, but I'm saying it's not a big deal in terms of, if you are homosexual, so you are. So, and I think hockey is ahead of the curve as compared to some other sports. And I think this is good leadership by Bill Daly and Gary Bettman. But I also think hockey players overall would be fairly accepting of this.
And I think, Richie, you know, to cut in really here, the NHL has its own, you know, machismo type of, you know, culture and all that. But when you compare it to football or basketball or baseball, I think, you know, hockey players look pretty good. And that's not to say, you know, that we won't see this type of partnership in the MLB or the NBA or the NFL. But, you know, I think it says a lot about Gary Bettman, Donald Fehr, you know, all the other guys in positions of leadership that are coming out and they're saying, this is a great initiative. Everybody's on board here. And that's what you want. I mean, we've said it, you know, on the show when we've talked about UCAM Play before. It's a great initiative. And it's just, I mean, we're living, this is the year 2013. I mean, you got to accept people for what they are. You have to, because that's the way the world is right now. And the people that don't are the ones that are shunned by society right now. And those are the people that become the focus, whether it's, you know, cyberbullying or all that. Those people are the ones that are cowards.
I agree with what both of you have said. I think also that the reason why the NHL is sort of the league leader in this, in terms of the big sports, has to do a little bit with the culture. You know, Canada obviously has had same-sex marriage law in place for close to a decade now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was the brouhaha when it was going on and when it finally passed. And since then, it's just sort of become the way of the land, and it hasn't really affected anything in an overwhelming manner. Now, obviously, there's still terrible homophobia in the world, and we're not making light of that. But it seems like Canadians have become accepting of same-sex marriage. So it seems logical that their hockey players, or, you know, Canada being, you know, the home of hockey and everything else, would also be the more accepting of a homosexual hockey player a little bit quicker than, say, the sports in the United States that are predominantly in the United States, where they're only now coming around to having that same-sex marriage discussion, and they're almost a decade behind Canada in some ways in their thinking on this matter.
Great point, Drew. And I think that's true in terms of the cultural effects of this decision. Also, going back to Brian Burke, remember also that Brian Burke and Gary Bettman are very close. I don't think that played a small part in this either. The trust level. Not that Gary Bettman wouldn't have considered it and implemented it in any event.
For those listening, you know, just quickly, Brian Burke used to work for the NHL, because some people don't know that. Right. So
he used to be the disciplinarian that Brendan Shanahan is now. Him and Gary Bettman are very close, and I think he has the ear of the NHL, and I think rightfully so in this instance.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, Donald Fehr and the NHLPA it seems like it was an easy decision for them to get formally involved, because so many of the teams, including the Winnipeg Jets and a number of Winnipeg Jets players, had already done sort of public service announcements in support of the You Can Play project. Remember, we had Patrick Burke on last year because the Jets were just announcing, or I believe it was, I'm trying to think who the players were.
I think Tanner Glass, Dustin Byfuglien was in there.
Yeah, they had all just taped a PSA in support of the You Can Play project.
Drew, you know what's also really important and extremely admirable about this? Of all the stuff that's going on in the world, this kind of shows you that, you know, there is more to just, you know, hockey on the ice as far as this league, this industry, this organization goes. You know, everything, you know, we're in the middle of, you know, playoff races. You know, there's the whole Olympic participation thing going on. And then you have You Can Play, you know, and the NHL, the NHLPA announcing this, everybody getting behind it. It becomes front page news. Everybody heard about this, whether it was on TSN or the Free Press or the Globe and Mail, whatever. It really shows you how important this is, because, you know, even though, you know, homophobia exists and a lot of organizations exist to promote eradicating the world and, you know, promoting the right of people to choose their own sexuality, the fact is there are still, I mean, we're getting a little off topic here, but look what happened with the restaurant, you know, outside of Winnipeg. We're not going to mention it, but there was some harassment to a couple of owners. I mean, there's still homophobia that exists, and it's important to have things like this, because, you know, it's not just to let you know, a gay player come out of the closet or announce, you know, his sexual orientation. You know, it's about really, you know, reducing stigmas and hatred that still, it's hard to believe, you know, that it exists, but it still does exist. So you're trying to really get rid of that. And that's important not just in hockey, but in the world in general.
This is a step forward. It's not the final step forward. And then, I mean, to your point, Ezzie Jackie Robinson's movie is coming out this week, the biopic.
called 42, and there's still racism in baseball. And this is a step. There hasn't been a formal homosexual player, at least, you know, say that he's homosexual while playing in the National Hockey League. I think that will come with time. I think the progression of the game and how the game adjusts to dealing with that now as opposed to how they would have dealt with it 30 years ago is another step. So this is a first step amongst many steps, but it's a step in the right direction.
Absolutely, and I think it also, you know, when you have that, when that first player comes out, or when you see that the NHL and NHLPA are stepping up in this matter, that will prevent the sort of juvenile conversations amongst, you know, in the locker rooms where that would potentially make somebody feel uncomfortable from even being an issue. You know, when guys rag on each other, rag on him for something else other than his sexuality, or using the term in a disrespectful manner or in a way to denigrate somebody. You know, make fun of, you know, we make fun of each other for all sorts of things, but that's never would be one of the things we would say, and that's to be for everybody.
Like when you went to school with Branch Rickey, Jackie Robinson's manager.
Exactly. You made that. You tried out that line at breakfast this morning. You were making fun of my age, and I'm fine with that.
Drew, I think, you know, what is really an interesting thing, and a thing that, again, is so great about this is, you know, it's one thing for someone to tell, you know, young kids that that's not okay, but when you have a guy like Dustin Byfuglien or Tanner Glass, you know, and you know, kids especially now are all on YouTube and on NHL.com, to have the faces of the NHL, for those guys to tell them that it's not okay, that's what's really important. They look at a guy like Steven Stamkos, the greatest goal scorer in the NHL. Alexander Ovechkin might have something to say about that. But Steven Stamkos, for him to say that, I think is really rings true for kids. And they see that and they say, okay, that's not okay.
Absolutely. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. The Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. This segment is brought to you by the Elite Sports Injury Clinic. Regardless of your talent level or how it happened, if you suffer pulls, tears, strains, or spasms, the Elite Sports Injury Clinic is your destination to get you back to health. Three convenient locations throughout Winnipeg means Elite Sports Injury Clinic is always readily available to get you back on the court. Check them out online at physiowinnipeg.com. Gentlemen, some playoff races that we haven't yet touched on. Those would be sort of the top of the Eastern Conference, the battle between the Bruins and the Montreal Canadiens for the Northeast Division lead. There's some great races going on over on the, in the Western Conference as well. But let's start with Montreal and Boston. Of course, it's two legendary rivals. The you know, two original six teams, they each have eight games left in the regular season, and the Montreal Canadiens lead the Boston Bruins by 1 point. How significant are the injuries that both sides have suffered? How significant are they in terms of determining who's going to be the victor in the Northeast Division?
Significant, I think, for Boston more than Montreal, Drew. I mean, Bergeron and Marchand. Now, Bergeron's been making progress. They think he might be back for Monday. He's not playing today. Could argue, you know, he's a top 10 NHL centerman, even higher than that. And obviously, Emelin's injury in Montreal is very significant, but I think Boston is a more affected squad.
I would agree with that. Patrice Bergeron, Richie, you know, we're teasing the audience a little bit because we're going to do our NHL awards with 3 weeks to go, actually more like 2 weeks to go at this point, towards the end of the show. But Patrice Bergeron was an MVP. He was a Hart candidate, as far as I'm concerned, let alone a Selke Trophy candidate, which he won the award last year. You know, because he's so influential on the outcome of a game with his face-off ability, his penalty-killing ability, his skating ability, everything. But, you know, the Boston Bruins, they play the Carolina Hurricanes tonight. And then you've got Montreal at Toronto, which is obviously going to be the marquee game on Hockey Night in Canada. But Toronto isn't going anywhere above fifth. But they're probably not going anywhere under sixth either. You could almost say that they're locked in because they're going to have two games in hand on the Jets, but one game in hand on the Senators and the Islanders. So there's a good chance the Leafs are going to either play the Bruins or the Habs, other teams in their division. They're not going to win the division. They have no chance. They're 8 points behind the Habs right now. But, you know, the Bruins are in a position where they would love to have Patrice Bergeron right now, but they all also have to be thinking, okay, we can't let up at all here, because if we do, you know, we might not win the division here. And, you know, sure, you get to play the Leafs, but you also don't want to limp in to the playoffs, even if you are playing the Leafs, which I would probably want to play over the Senators, because the Senators have better goaltending, you know, even though James Reimer has been good lately. You know, the Bruins are a team that, you know, they're in a position of strength as far as having home ice, but you'd have to think that they'd relish the thought of potentially playing the Islanders in the first round.
If you finish second, you conceivably avoid the Pittsburgh Penguins until the third round.
Mm-hmm.
That's so important.
Yeah, you're finished second, you're guaranteed to avoid
exactly.
Pittsburgh,
the Pittsburgh Penguins exactly.
Until the conference finals.
Without James Neal, I mean, and Sidney Crosby, they've still won three in a row. I mean, So when you talk about, you know, who's the deepest team in the league, I think mm-hmm. it begins and ends with the Pittsburgh Penguins. No offense to any other team, but, you know, Aginla and Morrow all of a sudden are really, you know, becoming a factor because you don't have James Neal on that second line. And you had I believe Letang is back now, but Letang was injured. So
he was cleared, yeah. And you look at the matchups as of today. Montreal finishes second. They play Islanders. And if they were to win and all the favorites were to win, they played Washington. So Washington versus Boston playing Toronto. And then Pittsburgh.
Yeah. It's a huge advantage winning the Northeast Division. Let's look at their schedules coming up for the last eight games. Montreal plays Toronto tonight in Toronto. Then they have Philly at home, Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, home to Tampa, home to Washington. Then they finish on the road for three games at New Jersey, at Winnipeg, and at Toronto. Not an easy schedule. You look at the, you know, two Toronto games, not easy.
Yeah.
The Pittsburgh game, not easy. The Washington game, not easy. And, I mean, who knows about the Jets game? You look at Boston's schedule. At Carolina, home to Ottawa, home to Buffalo, home to Pittsburgh, home to Florida, at Philly, home to Tampa, and at Washington. I think Boston's schedule is easier there.
I agree with you.
Now, it's also worth noting that at this point in time, the regulation wins are very close. Montreal has 23 regulation wins. Boston has 22 regulation wins.
Right.
So I mean,
but Boston has a game in hand.
Pardon me, Boston still has a game in hand. No, they don't.
Sorry, they don't.
Boston is 1 point behind Montreal, but they're even in terms of points. It's really almost that's a division that's too close to call. And so if you tie it back to the Jets fans were sort of hoping, well, Montreal is going to be home and cool. They may not have to give their entire effort for that game on Thursday the 25th. By the looks of it, I don't expect Montreal will have clinched anything other than a playoff spot at that point in time.
Guys, I know that right now the kind of, you know, romantic, you know, narrative, or I guess what people are hoping happens is that Montreal and Toronto play in the first round. Mm-hmm. But, you know, based on the way the Habs have played, the goaltending they've been getting, PK Subban and Andrei Markov are so good right now and have just been playing at such a high elite level for so long now. I don't see Montreal coming out of that second spot. And I think it's really, you know, you could almost argue Montreal is hungrier for that second spot because Boston has had it for so many years. But Montreal, it's been a while since they've had it. So, you know, even though, you know, Montreal doesn't have an easy schedule, I still see Montreal hanging on to that second spot. I think Boston's going to give them, you know, a nice little run. But without Bergeron, I think that's not good, you know, for them. So either way, I think if you look at, you know, who Montreal is going to face and who Boston's going to face, Boston must be pretty happy to face the Toronto Maple Leafs. You know, they're not exactly, you know, a five seed that you would look at and you would consider to be super dangerous. And the Islanders, they've won 8 of their last 10 games, you know, and have basically gone from a team on the fringe to a team that most people would think has a really good chance at making the playoffs. So for Montreal and Boston, you're probably going to have favorable first-round matchups. But just like what Richie said, the reason why you want that second spot is because you avoid Pittsburgh until the third round, most likely.
Absolutely. You look over to the Western Conference, and you have a real battle going on there for the 4, 5, and 6 positions between the Los Angeles Kings, the San Jose Sharks, and the St. Louis Blues. The Kings currently are in fourth in that division. They are I mean, they're going to finish at best fourth there because Anaheim's is going to win the Pacific Division. So LA's got 7 games remaining. They have 50 points. San Jose, which has a game in hand, has 49 points. And St. Louis, which has another game in hand, also has a game in hand on LA, has 48 points. So really the 4, 5, and 6 there are very close in terms of who's going to get that division.
San Jose only has 14 regulation wins, though.
Right, that's what I was going to say. San Jose is terrible in terms of the tiebreaker because their 14 regulation wins don't put them anywhere near the other teams in that conference.
That's the lowest of any playoff team in either conference.
Right. So you look at the Kings' schedule, 7 games left. They're home to Anaheim, difficult game, obviously. They're at San Jose. That game should really make a big difference. Home to Columbus, home to Dallas, at Minnesota, at Detroit, and home to San Jose. Not an easy schedule by any stretch of the imagination. Then you look at a team like the San Jose Sharks, at Dallas. Dallas currently out of the playoffs.
But they're streaking.
Streaking, but out of the playoffs. At Phoenix, out of the playoffs. Home to LA, home to Minnesota, home to Columbus, and home to Dallas again, and at Phoenix and at LA to end the regular season.
If you want an entertaining game tonight, you know, we talked about Montreal-Toronto. San Jose at Dallas. I watched the game last night, Dallas won. Alex Chiasson had 2 goals for the Dallas Stars. Since the Dallas Stars traded Derek Roy to Vancouver, what have they done? They've won 4 games in a row, and all of a sudden they're only a couple points behind the Red Wings for the last playoff spot. Unbelievable.
It's the same thing that the Buffalo Sabres did after trading at the trade deadline. You go on these streaks because you got nothing to lose.
Yep.
You got nothing to lose. I mean, the Toronto Blue Jays for a lot of years, after they'd been really more or less eliminated, would go on these great streaks in August or September when it's all just window dressing.
Yep.
It's a team that's got nothing to lose. They got nothing to really play for. They're playing loose and relaxed because what's the downside?
And that's also the other factor here in Dallas's particular place, maybe not so much the Blue Jays, but Dallas has a bunch of young players, Drew, who are playing for jobs next year.
Right.
So something's on the line for them.
But eventually, it does, in my opinion, they can't keep that momentum going.
Fair enough.
Eventually, they hit a roadblock like the Flyers did last Saturday when they had been on a hot streak, or the Sabres did on Tuesday when they had been on a sort of a hot streak. At some point in time, the talent disparity does win out.
Dallas wins. They play tonight, I think.
Against San Jose, yeah.
Dallas wins, and they have the tiebreaker over Detroit for the last spot, and they have the same amount of games left.
What about this? Columbus beat St. Louis yesterday, so now they're a couple points behind the Red Wings with the same amount of games played. What about the Minnesota Wild? The Minnesota Wild tonight are at home to the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Yeah, good point.
That might be a team that either the Columbus Blue Jackets, the Phoenix Coyotes, or the Dallas Stars catch. So you have a situation where right now both the Wild, who have lost 2 games in a row and have only won 4 of their last 10 games, the Minnesota Wild are in a position they might actually fall out of a playoff spot. A couple weeks ago, they were competing with the Canucks for the division lead.
Final point here. You look at the 1 through 8. All I really think, LA didn't have home ice at all last year and made the run. If I'm any team, right? If I have to pick any home team right now out of the first 4, Chicago, Anaheim, Vancouver, LA, I like LA's matchup the best because I think San Jose is not as good as St. Louis, Minnesota, or Detroit.
I think, you can almost see that in just the regulation wins. They've only cleanly won 14 games this year.
Yeah, if St. Louis creeps up to number 5, I don't like that matchup.
Yeah, no, you pick one team out of the West, and it's the San Jose Sharks you'd rather meet in the first round than anyone else. Let's go to break. When we come back, Damian Cristadero is going to join us to talk about the Tampa Bay Lightning. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Let's welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from the Tampa Bay Times. Damian Cristadero covers the Tampa Bay Lightning. Damian, good afternoon. Thanks very much for joining us.
Sure, no problem.
Damian, we got to start with the Lightning with the moves they made at the trade deadline, specifically acquiring Ben Bishop from the Ottawa Senators in exchange for Corey Conacher. How difficult was it for Steve Yzerman to give up a prospect like Conacher in exchange for Ben Bishop?
Well, I think it's always difficult when you give up a kid with as much promise and upside as a Corey Conacher, but I think that the kind of the dynamics have changed a little bit for Tampa Bay over the last couple of years. When Eiserman and his group came in, this organization was absolutely bare in the minor leagues. I mean, there was just nothing to choose from. They've really done a great job of restocking the minor league system. They're very, very deep at forward. And I think the calculation was, look, we're going to have to give up something to get something. Let's deal at least from strength. And they like I said, they are pretty deep at forward. Guys like Tyler Johnson, he really made an impression. They really think Brett Connolly has made a real step in the minor league this year. They thought they had some leeway, you know, some give there. And I think that's what they finally decided, that, you know, they needed this goalie badly, and they were going to have to give up something to get him. So at least they're dealing some strength.
Are you surprised at how poorly Lindback played for the Lightning since they acquired him? Was it time to give up on Anders Lindback that quickly?
Well, I guess, you know, Guy Boucher, when he was here, made some interesting admissions that they think that they really overworked Anders Lindback. They said at the beginning that they weren't going to, you know, give him the number one job. They weren't going to name him the number one, but they certainly played him that way. It was a pretty heavy workload, and you know that's a lot to ask from a kid who hadn't played much in the NHL before that. He had two seasons at as a backup to Pecorini in Nashville, and you know, maybe there was some pressure there, and maybe Anders just wasn't ready to be a full-time number one goalie. So that is a slight miscalculation on the Lightning's part. So, look, they go into next season with Ben Bishop and Anders Lindback. They claim they're going to let them both play and then let the situation evolve and see, you know, who grabs this number one job. And I think given the situation that they're in, that's probably the best they could do at this point.
Damian, the Tampa Bay Lightning come into Winnipeg on Tuesday night and play the Winnipeg Jets, and Jets fans here will remember Steven Stamkos scoring his 60th goal of the year. You know, we have to ask you about Steven Stamkos because, you know, right now he is fighting Alexander Ovechkin for the Rocket Richard Trophy, and it's even possible, as you mentioned in your article for the Tampa Bay Times, that, you know, he could catch Sidney Crosby for the Art Ross Trophy. You know, considering that the Lightning are eight points out of the playoffs with eight games to go. Is this something that's going to make watching the Tampa Bay Lightning exciting?
Well, you do need some reason, don't you? I guess, yes. That would be a reason. That would be a reason. I mean, look, it's a great race. You have Steven Stamkos and Alex Ovechkin, you know, two of the premier stars in the NHL, going for the Rocket Richard Trophy. I mean, I don't think you can get much better than that. Steven. The thing that of course the Lightning has to worry about is given that they're pretty much out of the playoff picture, you know, do they change what they're doing to try and feed Stamkos and make, you know, try and help him to get as many goals and points as possible, and I guess that's a danger, but look, if eight games left, like you said, they're out of the playoffs. I mean, they got to keep it interesting, and you know, Stamkos against Ovechkin, that's a pretty interesting matchup.
You know, Damian, when the Tampa Bay Lightning made the coaching change and they let Guy Boucher go, and actually the team was coming through Winnipeg, I guess the first part of that, you know, question is, were you surprised that they let Guy Boucher go?
I wasn't shocked that they let Guy Boucher go. I think the more of the surprise was the timing of it. They were still on the road, and I think it was a back-to-back, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there had been a lot of speculation that at the very least Eiserman was going to really take a hard look at what was going on with coaching over the summer. You know, Steve is very calculated. I mean, not a knee-jerk reaction kind of guy. So he must have seen something pretty significant in his mind to make the move when he did. So, like I said, I don't think the actual move in and of itself was shocking. I just think the timing of it was a little bit of a surprise.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Damian Christodoro of the Tampa Bay Times discussing the Tampa Bay Lightning ahead of their visit to Winnipeg on Tuesday to play the Winnipeg Jets.
Damian, Guy Boucher came in as much heralded, coming in from Hamilton of the AHL with Martin Raymond and Daniel Lacroix as his assistants. What was Guy Boucher's biggest downfall as coach of the Lightning?
Well, it's hard to say because we really never got a real accounting from, you know, I mean, a specific accounting. But, I mean, just from talking to kind of people and just watching what the team, how the team was performing, I would just say on a very basic level that they just weren't getting better. The team had kind of spun its wheels for a season and a half, if you want to call it a season and a half, given the you know what's gone on this year. But it was just stuck in the mud. It was just not making progress. And I think that's the way you evaluate a coach. I mean, a coach's job is to make players better, and it just wasn't happening. And in fact, with especially some of the veteran players, there was some regression. And I don't know if it's regression in the idea of that their skills were regressing. Right. It's just that you didn't see the effort. There was kind of a disengagement there, I think, especially with the veteran players between Boucher and some of the older guys.
Here in Winnipeg, of course, we didn't get to see new coach John Cooper behind the bench. That was the one game where the assistant coaches were the interim head coaches. What is John Cooper, I guess, like to deal with, and how is he different than Guy Boucher in that regard and in terms of his coaching style?
Well, they're pretty similar in the sense that they've been pretty open and they've been pretty accessible to media, and you know, Guy Boucher was a talker, so you know there was never any problem discussing things with Boucher. And Cooper too. I mean, he'll give you his time and answer whatever you want. I think that for me the biggest difference was that Cooper came out right at the beginning and said, look, you know, I'm not going to be as structured as other NHL coaches might be. I mean, I think the perception was Guy Boucher was very, very structured in where he wanted players to go, what he wanted them to do in situations. And Cooper said, look, you know, these are NHL guys. They're really talented. Let's, you know, let them breathe. And that's actually the term that he used, let them breathe. So he gives, you know, it's not that he doesn't have a system and he doesn't have expectations of how he wants them to play, but he said he's going to give them some leeway to use their instincts a little bit more, to use their talent, and maybe to create a little more on their own offensively. And I thought, for me, that was the most significant difference.
Damian, we wanted to ask you about a couple of defensemen that maybe Winnipeg Jets fans aren't super familiar with, even though one of them was in Winnipeg last time the Lightning were in town, those being Mark Barberio and Radko Gudas. Different players, Radko Gudas being more of a physical defenseman, I think you'd agree. But Mark Barberio is a guy that, you know, put up big-time numbers, I believe was an all-star in the AHL this year and had 61 points last year in the AHL. Are those a couple of guys that, you know, Lightning fans should get excited about as far as being part of the future there on D?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, Gudas has been here for a bit now, and he's really, you know, he's established himself as being a pretty stable defenseman, and certainly he's willing to be physical, and that's something that this team really needs a little bit more of. So he really added an element that they hadn't had before. Barberio, you're right. I mean, it's just big offensive numbers. He actually was the AHL Defenseman of the Year last season when the Lightning had their affiliate in Norfolk. Look, the Lightning hasn't had a real offensive threat from the blue line since Dan Boyle, and, you know, that's, what, 5 years ago now. And not that Mark Barberio is going to be a Dan Boyle. I mean, that would be, you know, asking a lot. But he certainly has the instinct to provide something that this team hasn't seen in a while. Just a guy who's really confident moving the puck, you know, not only handling it, making the pass, and being a quarterback on the power play. I mean, ever since he's been up here, he's gotten a lot of time on the power play. That's six for his last 13. So certainly the Lightning is looking to Mark to kind of, you know, get acclimated this season and then perhaps take an even bigger role next season. But he's definitely someone to keep an eye on.
Damian, we'll let you go on this last question. It's also along the lines of the defense. Obviously, there's no offensive problems with the Lightning. I mean, you know, you go through their offensive firepower. It's up at the top of the league. They think they've solved the problem in net with the Ben Bishop acquisition. The Lightning defense, as currently constructed, is it good enough for the Lightning to win in the NHL?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think you would get that argument from anyone. I think if the Lightning is going to do anything over the summer, and it's not even sure that they're going to do that, I would have to think that the point of emphasis is going to be trying to at least solidify, if not, you know, upgrade the defense a little bit. But they have some good pieces here. Barberio, you know, down the road is going to be very good. Gudas is going to when stability and physical nature. Victor Hedman, I mean, is just going to be, you know, on out of this world, given another season or two. He took a huge step this year. So I think with a few tweaks, the defense could be good that way. I just don't think it's there quite yet.
Damian Cristadero from the Tampa Bay Times. We'll see you Tuesday night in Winnipeg. Thanks very much for joining us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Sure, guys. Anytime.
Take care, Damian. Thanks very much. Let's go to break. When we come back, one final segment. It's rapid fire, and we'll deal with the NHL awards. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. One final segment on this Saturday afternoon. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Rapid fire.
Rapid fire for this Saturday afternoon to wrap up the show. We had been discussing this off air this week about how this is almost as much of a wide open year for the NHL awards as we can remember. So rapid fire today will deal with who my colleagues Richard and Ezra think are going to win each and every NHL award. Let's start with the Hart Trophy awarded to the most valuable player in the NHL. Gentlemen, who's your Hart Trophy winner this year?
I'm going to go with Jonathan Toews of the Chicago Blackhawks. You know, we all know what he did for the Chicago Blackhawks during that playoff run, and he's the captain now. But he's so good defensively, and he's been so good offensively. But he's the jack of all trades for that team, and he's carried the team on his back the whole year. And I think, you know, without a player like that, I know Patrick Kane is good, but Patrick Sharp was out for a little bit. So my MVP is Johnny Toews.
Hard to argue with that. I mean, I think Crosby is my MVP just because of how dominant he's been. And the truth is, the Penguins were kind of first way ahead of the pack by the time he got hurt. I know it's a short season. I don't want to hold the broken jaw against him. I would give him the MVP. But to me, there's the three finalists would be Toews, Tavares, and Crosby. You know, Ovechkin and Kane are a little bit in the way out. Ovechkin didn't play the whole season. I realize he's turned it on, but they still may miss the playoffs. I would give it to Crosby.
Vezina Trophy for the best goaltender in the NHL. You know, Craig Anderson at first was making a pretty good case, but he's been injured for a while. Who is your goaltender of the year in the NHL?
For me, it's Carey Price, Drew. He's been one of the busiest goaltenders in the NHL. Peter Budaj has played well in relief, but you know, Carey Price, for me, from the start of the season, has been there. You know, his numbers are really good. He's got the win totals. So for me, it's Price.
Another tough one.
It's the reason why we're doing the second.
Yeah, I mean, Carey Price, I like that pick. If Lundqvist gets the Rangers into the playoffs with the disaster that they've been and how good he's been, I think I'd probably vote for Lundqvist. But I think Lundqvist is in the conversation, and then you have Price and... You know, I mean, do you want to toss in
Tuukka Rask?
Yeah, Tuukka Rask. And then what if Bobrovsky gets Columbus into the playoffs? But I right now would go with Lundqvist because the Rangers have just been a disaster this year. And without him, I don't think they'd be in this playoff conversation.
No love for Corey Schneider? Leads the NHL in shutouts. Goals against average of 2.0.
But I mean, you look at Lundqvist played 35 games and you look at and Schneider 25.
I mean,
if you don't place as much of an emphasis on games played, I mean, you could even throw in Ray Emery. Yeah. We mentioned that on Wednesday. His numbers are, I think he's only lost two games this year.
He's lost one game in regulation.
One game, so yeah. There you go.
Norris Trophy for the best defenseman.
The Norris Trophy is a really hard one. Obviously, Erik Karlsson came out of nowhere to win it last year, but when we were picking our Canadian Olympic rosters, I said PK Subban, and you guys didn't laugh at me, but maybe...
Well, we probably laughed at you for something else.
Well, you're probably going to get... You know, PK Subban, nobody else picked on the Olympic roster, and Richie might not pick him again. I don't know. But I'm going to give PK Subban the Norris. I think, considering that he came into the season late and missed a few games at the beginning of the season because of his contract status, I think he's just been unbelievable, not just offensively, but defensively. And he's just been a huge part of Montreal's success, so I'm going to go Subban.
PK Subban's a point of game.
Mm-hmm.
And Andre Markov's obviously been terrific. I mean, he really should be in that conversation as well. But to me, you're looking at a PK Subban versus Ryan Suter argument.
I'd agree with that.
And I know that Suter went to Minnesota and signed there with Prince Day, and that there was a lot of pressure. And I know he plays more minutes a game than Subban.
Almost 4 minutes. Yeah. Actually, more than 4 minutes a game more than PK Subban.
But PK Subban plays in the biggest pressure cooker there is. And he's played less games, but he's had just a monster impact in the game he's played. He's improved his game leaps and bounds this year. And Suter took a while to get going too, remember that guy. So, you know, Subban had a little bit of a delay, but Suter took a while to get going. I would give it to Subban.
Coach of the year, Jack Adams Trophy winner.
Hardest one. And
it really is.
Who are your candidates?
You're going to talk about Quenneville.
How do we even decide on the candidates?
Quenneville's...
it's hard to narrow it down to just three.
Quenneville's
right.
One.
Quenneville in Chicago.
I think Therrien in Montreal. Mm-hmm. I think Paul MacLean in Ottawa. I think those are my top three. Maybe I'm forgetting somebody here. And Boudreaux and Carlisle. I mean, there's those five probably. You could really go on. Paul MacLean has done miracle work as far as I'm concerned. I mean, that got Mihalik back yesterday. We've talked about it. No Spezza, no Carlson, no Jared Cowan. Injuries, a young team riding Zibanejad and riding Silverberg and riding the back end guys we talked about on Wednesday's show, rotating through three goalies and keeping the three goalies pretty happy. They weren't infighting. Paul MacLean gets my nod so long as they make the playoffs.
This will matter if they make the playoffs or not, even though I don't think it should matter. I'm going to go a little bit off the board here. He trimmed down a little bit this year. Jack Capuano of the New York Islanders is going to be my choice. And if they fall out, I don't think that's going to be an option, to be honest with you. But, you know, John Tavares is obviously, as Richie mentioned, could be a Hart Trophy candidate. But, you know, he's had issues on defense. He's had issues in goal. Travis Hamonic is injured right now, so that's not good for their playoff chances. But Jack Capuano has done a great job because they were out of it at the midway point of the season, and they've won 8 of their last 10 games when it matters most. So for me, it's Capuano.
Rookie of the year, Calder Trophy.
We'll start off. I mean, Jonathan Huberdeau is leading all rookies in points right now. I'm going to go Brendan Gallagher of the Montreal Canadiens. I really like his game. I don't think he is going to win it. He might not even get a nomination. There's a lot of good rookies this year. You know, Brandon Saad's a guy that not a lot of people have talked about in the Chicago Blackhawks, but I really like Brendan Gallagher. To me, he plays a type of game that Brad Marchand plays in Boston, and I'm kind of picking him more so because I like him. So even though I think he's up there in points, but not first, Huberto is. So I'll go Gallagher.
You know, Corey Koninger, I think, has to be in the conversation, too, and I know he's faded down, but as Drew, you mentioned before the show, there really hasn't been a blow-away rookie this year. And it's almost by default, probably, when you're looking at, you know, you can look at, if you're looking at the back end, I want to quickly break it down, back end and up front. Dougie Hamilton's had a really nice year. Now he's healthy scratch coming down here, and he's fading a bit. Jake Muzzin came out of nowhere, has he?
What about the guy that everybody thought was going to be the blowout player, Yakupov?
Yakupov?
He's got him as their Calder winner.
What about Schultz? He has enough point every other game. And then Jonas Brodin, a guy who doesn't get a lot of points, but has played a huge role in Minnesota's success. I mean, I think he has to be in the conversation.
Yep.
And Zibanejad's come on a lot. So there is
no clear-cut winner.
Yeah, this one, and you mentioned Saad. That's one of the tough ones. I would actually give it to Brodin, considering how nobody offensively has blown me away, but defensively he's taken on a lot of responsibility.
Are we doing the Lady Bing? Because I'll give it to Evander Kane.
Very quickly, Frank, the Selke Award winner.
Patrice Bergeron has been an absolutely dominant two-way player. I think he wins. Taves is in the conversation. There's some other guys in the conversation, but Bergeron, to me, hands down.
I'll go with a former multiple winner. I'm going to give Datsyuk the Selke.
Okay, let's wrap up the program.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy. And jeers.
No, not good enough.
He's a bad boy.
I never seen something stink like this.
Surprisingly not good.
Richard Pollock.
I'm going to give my cheer to, as we spoke about earlier in the show, the NHL combining with You Can Play Project and formally putting their weight behind that effort. I think that's absolutely should be applauded and gets my cheer this week.
Ezra Ginsberg.
I'm going to cheer Drew LeBlanc. He won the Hobie Baker Award, played for St. Cloud. They were knocked out recently out of the Frozen Four tournament. They were Quinnipiac and Yale today, I believe. I'm not sure what time, but he signed a contract with the Chicago Blackhawks. So it's a pretty good day for him.
What about Drew LeBum over there?
Thank you. I'm honored. I'm going to wrap up cheers and jeers. I'm going to jeer the Toronto Maple Leafs and Randy Carlyle for the manner in which they've handled the Joffrey Leupold concussion, which everybody knew was a concussion, and it took them 5 days to admit it was a concussion. And then Carlyle decided that it's necessary to blame the helmets for the concussion. Randy, you're a hockey coach, and you're a very good hockey coach. Stick to being a hockey coach. Stop giving us your neurosurgeon ideas in regards to concussion. Leave that to the experts, in my opinion. Yes, Richard?
Is that Drew or Dave Hodge over there?
It's very clever. But anyways, I just think that the Toronto Maple Leafs organization handled this concussion in a manner similar to how a team would handle it 10 years ago when concussions weren't as big of a deal as they normally are. That's it for this Saturday in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to our guests, Chuck Gormley and Damian Cristadero. In case you missed any of the program, it will be available for download on iTunes and on the TSN1290.ca website. Big thank you to our sponsors, Bernstein's Deli, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, the Linden Market Dental Center, the Elite Sports Injury Clinic, the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba, and David Carr of Monopoly Realty. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is www.illegalcurve.com. Wednesday night, 6 p.m., NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. For producer Remus and producer Tim, for Ezra Ginsberg and Richard Pollock, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Thanks for listening. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.